On the eve of this great adventure, I send my best wishes to everyone who is given the honor of striking a blow for freedom which will live in history, and in the better days that lie, pride of our doings. We have a great and a righteous cause. Let us pray that the Lord will go forth with our armies, and that his special providence will aid us in the struggle. I want that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. With stout hearts and with enthusiasm for the contest, let us go forward to victory.
Now the ships are sealed and we wait. The troops swarmed up the rope ladders last night. Strong, healthy, formidable men, many of them going into battle for the first time. At every minute of the day and the night, the ship and the men aboard her are alert. Plans of immense complexity are being studied, and every man, soldier or sailor, is learning to the last detail the part that he himself has to play. As you walk along the decks, men are reading, or sleeping, or talking in small clusters. Across the water, we can hear the jazz from a minesweeper's gramophone. There's a tenseness in the air, as every man aboard waits for the moment to which everything has been bent in these last few years. Sometimes they talk of home. An hour or 3 thousand, and then they were here again. Here, wondering and waiting and ready. Ready for the night, not far ahead now, when we sail from Britain under a full moon, with course set for France.
England has become one vast ordnance dump and field park. I've driven through it today for the best part of 100 miles, the road, and lined often enough on both sides with vehicles of all kinds, just pulled off and parked on the verges. There's plenty of cover to be had at this time of the year, and for all its concentration, this stuff is well hidden from observation from above. In every wood and copse, in leafy dead-end lanes and side roads, often in private gardens, under quarries and embankments, there it all was. Trucks, ambulances, tanks, armoured cars, carriers, jeeps, bulldozers, ducks, vehicles of all kinds. Vast, really vast numbers of them. And great mountains of stores, weapons and ammunition, rations, bridging equipment, tyres, timber, millions of tons, often with special railway tracks laid from dump to dump around great areas of dispersal. And as of men in battle dress, men marching, men running, men deploying on exercises, men being transported here and there by the thousand in trucks and lorries, men testing their equipment, tuning up their engines, waterproofing their vehicles, raising great sweeping clouds of yellow dust as their tanks bump and crash along the test tracks. We saw the temporary homes of these men, acre upon acre of camouflage tenting, tents spread out everywhere, hundreds of them just simply pitched by the roadsides on the grass verges. The people who actually live in these parts must feel as if some mammoth circus has suddenly sprung up round them. Certainly, in the whole history of the world, there never has been such a vast concentration of all the paraphernalia of war in so small a space. Right in the midst of it all, just as I turned for home, I passed a field where 22 men in khaki shirts and battle-dress trousers and heavy hobnail boots were having a quiet knock-up game of cricket. They made me think of Francis Drake and Plymouth Hoe.
It's 8:20 in the evening, and that and I have only a few hours to H hour. At any time now, we may see action. At any moment, the German advanced defences may come into play. And so, while we steam steadily along a course that's carrying us south towards the Seine, I'm taking this chance of recording. At noon today, we raised anchor, and we were ready to go. Slowly and majestically, as minesweepers and destroyers curved their way into position, we gave the lead to the other transports. Under a grey sky, we looked at the coast of Britain and watched it slowly grow more dim. On the decks and in the holds, the soldiers were waiting. For the most part, standing about, looking out to sea, talking now and then, and thinking. In the wardroom, dinner. From the menu, soup, roast beef and green peas, and apples and cream, it might have been a crossing to Cherbourg in peacetime. And then you realized that your hand was moving just a little sluggishly to your mouth. Your tummy wasn't just where it usually was. The men around you were rather silent, and when they spoke, they were self-conscious. It was a room full of men on the way, wondering, waiting, and listening. On deck, signals were flashing between ships. Enterprise had run up a flag signal. Boat crews were making their final preparations. There was a tenseness and a sense of good humor and good fellowship that were impossible of translation into words. And now, as the time draws near for darkness, and we sail steadily nearer to the coastline of France, most of those same things are still happening. Every man is wondering. Every man is completely calm.
It starts on an airfield, this story. It starts on an airfield where the paratroops kneel round their padre in prayer before emplaning. With bent heads and on bent knees, the men, with their equipment and camouflaged faces, look like some strange creatures from another world. And darkness comes over the airfield, and the men sling their explosives and weapons around them, get into their parachutes and emplane. They are going to jump, carrying heavier loads than any army has ever done before. You see every extra bullet and every extra grenade will count. In the plane, we stand packed abreast. I'm jumping, one but last of my stick. And as we stand there in these planes, for there's no room to sit, we feel the tremendous vibration of the four motors as we start down the runway. And all around in the coming darkness are other great planes and row upon row of gliders. And the plane is airborne. And in the crowded fuselage, all you see in the pale light of an orange bulb is the man standing next to you. And on we fly, on and out over the channel. And the minutes go by, and the stick commander says that the pilot has told him we're out over a great armada of naval ships. And then it's something else he has to say. Something that gives you a dry feeling in your mouth. Flak. And the word is passed from man to man. The machine starts to rock and jump. But a comforting thought, ahead of us, Lancasters are going in to bomb the flak and a coastal battery, which is one of our objectives. We're over the enemy coast now, and the run-in has started. 1 minute, 30 seconds, red light, green light, and out, out, get on, get out, get out. Out fast into the cool night. Out, out into the air over France. And we know that the dropping zone is obstructed. We're jumping, in fact, into fields covered with poles. But I hit my chute and lower my kit bag, which suspends on the end of a 40-foot rope from my harness. And then the ground comes up to hit me, and I find myself in the middle of a cornfield. I look around, and even with a compass, I can't be quite sure where I am. And overhead, hundreds of parachutes and containers are coming down. The whole sky now is a fantastic chimera of lights and flak, and one plane gets hit and disintegrates wholesale, sprinkling a myriad of burning pieces all over the sky. The job of the unit with which I jumped was to occupy the area and prepare the way for gliders. So we were to rendezvous near a copse, but I can't find it. So I go to a farmhouse and ask the way to a farmer and his wife standing on the porch of their house. We've come to drive the Boche away, I say. The farmer shrugs his shoulders in the dim light and says, I don't believe it.
With grinding brakes and creaking timbers, we jolted, lurched, and were landing in northern France early this morning. The glider in which I travelled came off better than most. The bottom of the nose was battered in. The wings and tail assembly were slashed here and there. But she came to rest on her three wheels, even though she had mown down five stout posts that came in her path. And although we virtually crash-landed in a ploughed field. As the tug left us, we dropped speed and went into a slow, gliding descent. 500 feet up, it was just clear enough for the pilots to distinguish the white roads bounding the fields where we were to land. For an instant, he caught a glimpse of the guiding lights at one end of the rough runway. He put the nose down. We stiffened ourselves for the jolt of the touchdown and lifted our feet clear of the floor in case something might rip through the belly. The touchdown itself was perfect, but as the wheels bounced and lurched over the furrows and ditches, we heard the harsh straining of the wooden fuselage, the crash of posts hitting the nose and undercarriage. No one was even scratched. We shouted with joy and relief and bundled out into the field. Around us we could see the silhouettes of other gliders, twisted and wrecked, making grotesque patterns against the sky. Some had buried their noses in the soil. Others had lost a wheel or a wing. One had crashed into a house. Two had crashed into each other. And yet as we marched off past these twists and for our own good fortune, other troops were clambering out of almost every one of these as casually as they might leave a bus. Some had to slash away the wooden fuselage before they could get out their jeeps and trailers. But almost without exception, they soon had them on the road. The guns, transport, signal gear, and other heavy equipment for the paratroops who'd been dropped earlier had been landed in France.
The day has broken now. The day has become clear. The sky is blue, although there's still a good deal of cloud about, and the sun is streaming through. The whole sea is a glittering expanse of green with white crests everywhere. And everywhere, too, there are ships. Every kind of ship one can imagine that would be needed in an invasion. There are all our landing craft for tanks, for infantry, for every type of supplies. There are great troop ships in great number. There are battleships, smaller warships, destroyers, patrol craft, escort ships. And in the sky overhead, there are aircraft of about half a dozen different kinds that I can see at this moment. One could not imagine a more stupendous scene. All of these ships, all taking their various parts in this invasion. The whole sea itself seems restless and excited with the tension of the moment. The sky is moving and changing the whole time in a high wind that is sweeping, and in this dramatic natural setting, we are moving towards the shore. The battleships and other bombardment ships over on the flank are pouring in their fire, and now other warships moving across our path are laying a smoke screen that is taking the place of the cloud which formerly lay over the waters. A dense smoke screen over on one quarter, and now there's a signal from the flagship.
All hands to beaching station.
All hands to beaching station. That's the signal for our sailors on board this craft to get ready for the landing.
Still, the landing crafts were lowered, and as the light broke and we really could see around us, we began to become aware of the formidable character of this invasion fleet of which we were a part. All over the blue-green water, the water which was extremely choppy and wind-flecked, we saw the various types of craft which go to make up an invasion fleet. And before very long, we were among them. I was in a barge which was due to pick up the brigadier of an assault group, and we were going in with the first assault wave. So we circled round with the various types of vessels, opening fire on the beach, which we could see quite plainly in the dim morning light, opening fire on the beach in their own manners and at the appointed time. First of all, the cruisers started with a rather loudly bang. And soon the air grew heavy with the smell of cordite and loud with the sound of explosions. And looking along the beach, we could see the explosions of our artillery creating a great cloud and fog of smoke.
This is the day and this is the hour. The sky is lightning, lightning over the coast of Europe as we go in. The sky is lighter and the sea is brighter, but along the shore there's a dense smoke screen as the battleships and the warships, the smaller warships, sweep along there, firing all the time against the shore and some of them laying a smoke screen for us. The sun is blazing down brightly now. It's almost like an omen, the way it suddenly come out just as we were going in. The whole sky is bright. The sea is a glittering mass of silver, with all these craft of every kind moving across it, and the great battleships in the background blazing away at the shore. There go the craft past us, the other landing craft. Some are left behind, the slower ones, each taking their part and going in at the right time for their right job. Destroyers, corvettes, patrol buses. I can hear the sound of anti-aircraft fire. I can't see yet whether it's our people who are being attacked. There's an enormous cloud of smoke along the shore, not only from the smoke screen, but from this terrific bombardment. All the ships are blazing away now. All around this enormous circle, there are ships. Ships moving in, ships on patrol, ships circling, ships standing to and firing. We're passing close by a cruiser that has been taking part in the bombardment, but is now on, I imagine, a sort of general patrol. You can't imagine anything like this march of ships, like soldiers marching in line. I've never seen anything so expressive of intense. It's a purpose shared among many ships and among many hundreds of thousands of fighting men who are going in now to the coast of Europe to do the biggest job they've ever had to do. I can't record any more now because the time has come for me to get my kit on my back and get ready to step off on that shore. And it's a great day.
This is London. London calling in the home, overseas, and European services of the BBC and through United Nations Radio Mediterranean. And this is John Snagg speaking. Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force, have just issued communique number one, and in a few seconds I will read it to you. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. I'll repeat that communique. Communique number one. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
We drove into the beach, swinging rather broadside on in the wind and the waves, seeing the jets of smoke from bursting shells near us in the water and slightly further away on the beach itself. And suddenly, as we tried to get between two of these tripod defense systems of the Germans, our craft swung, we touched a mine, there was a very loud explosion, a sudden ring. A shudder, the whole craft, and water began pouring in. Well, we were some way out from the beach at that point. The ramp was lowered at once, and out of the barge drove the Bren gun carrier into about 5 feet of water, with the barge settling heavily in the meanwhile. Well, the Bren gun carrier somehow managed to get through it, and we followed wading ashore. Well, that was one quite typical instance of how people got ashore, and when they got ashore seemed to be in perfectly good order, because the troops out of that barge immediately assembled and went to their appointed places, and there was no semblance of any kind of confusion. But the scene on the beach, until one had sorted it out, was at first rather depressing, because we did see a great many barges in difficulties with these anti-tank screens. And we noticed that a number of them had struck mines, as ours had struck mines. But then we began to see that, in fact, the proportion which had got through was very much greater. And the troops were moving all along the roads, the tanks were out already and going up the hills, that, in fact, we were dominating the situation. And that our main enemy was the weather, and that we were beating the weather. That we had our troops and our tanks ashore, and that the Germans weren't really putting up a great deal of resistance. Well, after spending some time on the beach talking to troops, finding them in tremendous fettle, very, very delighted at having this crack at the Germans, the next problem came to get away and to come back and do this news bulletin. Well, very quickly, I'll tell you what happened. It was again a question of wading out, picking up a barge which was leaving the beach, finding that that had been held by the enemy, the port engine had been shot up and the barge was sinking, and therefore transferring to another craft, getting onto a headquarters ship, finally getting into an ML and getting back just in time to tell you that all is going well, and that there is reason, if one may judge from the individual spirits of the men on the beaches, not from the military picture alone, which obviously I haven't been able to see, there is every reason for the highest confidence.
The British, Canadian, and American troops who landed on the coast of France, north of the lovely town of Caen, in broad daylight this morning, are already several miles inland, on a front sufficiently broad to be more than a bridgehead. They are pushing steadily on, backed by the tremendous firepower of heavy British and United States warships, and covered by an ever-changing but ever-present umbrella of fighters. The first phase of the great operation began about midnight last night when a force of parachutists and glider troops, some of which I saw taking off in the dying light of yesterday, landed on the eastern side of the chosen area to secure that flank. Today, the gliders and some of the discarded parachutes lie like crumpled flowers in the wet, wooded countryside northeast of Caen. Evidence enough that our airborne troops have successfully completed this, the first of their operations in the new battle of Europe. West of them, lying in a broad sweep rounding towards the peninsula of Cherbourg, are the beaches on which British, Canadians and Americans made an early breakfast time landing of unexpected ease today. They came in masses of landing craft that followed each other so closely in their flotillas that the channel, through the clouds and the rain, looked solid with ships. Someone said you could have walked across on them. They came inshore under the battering cover of the heavy naval guns, which put down a terrifying curtain of fire on the German coastal gun pits. One of these at least erupted into flame and smoke and disappeared when hit directly by a battleship shell. The naval barrage, part of which was being guided by our aircraft flying up and down the coast, was of remarkable strength and accuracy. It has gone on hour after hour, and certainly it had not ended at noon today. One of our fighters disintegrated in midair. There was no flak, there were no enemy fighters. The only explanation seemed to be that it was hit by a naval shell on its way to the proper target. Under the brute force of this bombardment, the shore of the bay and the areas immediately inland have been torn up. Even from several thousand feet, the craters lie like pockmarks across the green and sandy ground. The first parties ashore this morning worked at splendid speed. By 10:30, quite apart from the sappers, the infantry and the tanks already pushing into France, there were two sizable bulldozers ashore, working on a stretch of road that will become the Royal Air Force's first landing strip in France, and it's going to be ready very soon for the fighters to use. It's too early yet, much too early, to start giving any reasons for the comparative lack of resistance put up by the Germans to our initial landing. But most certainly, the first foothold was obtained easier than anyone had dared to hope. This time, we have cashed in on our success, and wave after wave of landing craft have been crossing the channel, unloading reinforcements and stores and armor. Our tanks can be seen moving inland, not far from the burning ruin of a small town that suffered the naval barrage. Of enemy troop movements, there was, until noon today, little or no sign from the air, even close to the immediate battle area. Long stretches of empty roads, shining with rain, deserted, dripping woods and damp fields. Static, quiet, perhaps uncannily quiet, and possibly not to remain quiet. But here and there a movement to catch the eye. A pathetic little procession of civilian refugees, carts loaded high with furniture and bundles, and all the domestic animals around them, making away from Caen. But here let it be noted that unless they departed long ago, the majority of our friends in France are obeying the order to stand fast. And then, as our aircraft on reconnaissance roared over a large and suspicious wood, three German soldiers running like mad across the main road to fling themselves into cover. And nearer the battle area, much nearer the battle area than they, outside the historic town of Bayeux, a solitary peasant harrowing his field, up and down behind the horses, looking nowhere but before him and at the soil. If quiet on the ground, it is certainly quiet in the air, where the Luftwaffe has simply stayed away. Reconnaissance aircraft, flying low and repeatedly over the landing area, were entirely unmolested by the enemy. One pilot came back and declared that it just wasn't worth going, except as a test of skill in dodging other Allied aircraft in the crowded sky. That was the picture at noon today. I feel I should repeat that there may be a change on the way. But at any rate, it is proper to report that the first phase of the attack on Western Europe has gone not only according to plan, but according